When Judas had left them, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and God will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little while longer. I give you a new commandment: love one another. As I have loved you, so you also should love one another. This is how all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." The Gospel of the Lord. I don't know when the last time you read John's Gospel was, just sat down and read it. I'm guessing for some of us, never, which is fine. I would recommend that you read it sometime, because there is, within each of the Gospels, of course, within any book of Scripture, there is kind of a form in the book itself. So John's Gospel, it's very different than the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It was written much later, decades later than the other Gospels. So those Gospels were sort of in circulation. John, knew people had those Gospels in their hand. They knew the story. John was writing a much more theological Gospel. John's Gospel goes deep. And if you were to read the whole book in context, you would see, for instance, that some of these little pieces that we get, pulled out a week at a time, you would see where they come from. So, for instance, there are 21 chapters. It might be 22, but I think it's 21. Yeah, it's 21. There's 21 chapters in the Gospel of John. 5 of those chapters take place at the Last Supper. That's a massive percentage of the Gospel. And it's the dialogue between Jesus and his disciples, and then the prayer of Jesus to the Father at the Last Supper. So that's where this Gospel is taken from. And in fact, Jesus is about to enter, this is sort of his last conversation with his disciples before he enters into his passion. And that's really indicated by the first word of the Gospel today, when Judas had left them, right? So Judas, Jesus has just told the disciples, one of you is going to betray me, and Judas leaves to go betray him. So the game is afoot, right? The betrayal is about to happen. He's on his way to his passion, and this is the context in which he begins to speak to his disciples. Now, this is bad preaching practice. We're not supposed to just read the scripture to you, but this is short. So I want to read the Gospel again, and what I want you to notice this time is that it appears, this passage, almost to have two parts. There's a part which, in the beginning, speaks of glory, and then the second part speaks of the commandment of love. And let's just, and if you have it with you, maybe you can read it with me, because I want to talk about how these two things are not, they're not actually two different ideas, but it's a flow of idea. So when Judas had left them, Jesus said, "Now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will also glorify him in himself, and God will glorify him at once. My children, I will be with you only a little while longer. I give you a new commandment: love one another. As I have loved you, so you also should love one another. This is how all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another." So you can see the first couple sentences, actually it's one sentence, Jesus is speaking about glory, which is a hugely important word in the scriptures, and in my opinion, a very difficult thing to define. I just finished, it's been kind of a labor of love the last couple of years, I just finished like a 3,000 page plus series on glory. And, I finished literally yesterday, and I don't really feel like I can tell you what glory is right now, at least not within the limits of a homily that won't keep you here all day. But maybe we can try to give a little understanding of glory. So one thing I like to say is that glory is like the beauty of God, right? So St. Thomas Aquinas says the beauty is the intersection of form and splendor, right? So that anything that's created, God creates everything good. Anything that's created has truth and goodness in it. And it manifests itself, which is why we're able to see it. And beauty is how goodness and truth manifest themselves. At least that's how it's supposed to be. Right? Sometimes physical beauty can lie to us. We can make things physically beautiful that are actually bad and untrue. But the way it's supposed to be in creation is that Beauty is goodness manifesting itself to us so that we can perceive it, so we can see it and grasp it as good. Right? So if glory is the beauty of God, glory is essentially when God pulls back the curtain, so to speak, and lets us see, even if in a limited extent, himself or some truth about himself or who he really is or how he really is. So Jesus, who knows he's about to be betrayed, right? Judas leaves the room and says, let's talk about glory. Now the Son of Man will be glorified. And God is glorified in him. What he's saying is that as he enters into his passion, as he's nailed to the cross, in some sense, a veil is going to be pulled back and we are going to see God's goodness. Now, Jesus gives lots of little glimpses of glory, right? All the miracles that Jesus performs in the Gospels, as I've said many times here in this church, when we read about miracles in the Gospels, we remember they point to something more important, which is who Jesus is, right? They're sort of little signs of the Lord's power over creation, which point to who he is as a creator. But he's really revealed as the Messiah. He's really revealed, really glorified on the cross. And there's this beautiful, in some sense awful, but beautifully awful, fact that there are all those ironic acknowledgments of who Jesus is and his passion, right? He's crowned, Jesus is king. He reigns from the cross, but his crown is a crown of thorns, right? He has purple robe placed on him, which is what a king would wear, but it's placed in mockery. Right? And he has Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews, which in fact he is, nailed in a sense, kind of making fun of the entire situation. So there's that that sort of tragic, gut-wrenching beauty of the fact that despite themselves, the Jews, the Romans, Pontius Pilate, they are actually acknowledging who he is as he enters into his suffering in the cross, right? So this is glory. Jesus really comes into his glory and is glorified on the cross. And the reason we can say this is his glory is when we look at Jesus Christ crucified, we see what kind of Messiah he is. And in looking at him crucified, we see what kind of God the Father is. He's a God who loves us, a God who loves us all the way to the end. So this is the first part of this gospel passage. The second part, he speaks about this new commandment to love one another even as I have loved you. As I have loved you, so also you should love one another. And he says, this is how people will know that you are my disciples. So given what we just said about glory, I think you can actually see that loving each other is an occasion of glory for Christians. The idea is that people should be able to look at the way we love. They should be able to look at the love that Christians have for one another and have that love then be transparent to God himself. Right? In other words, people should be able to look and see the truth and of who we are and what we believe by how we live. And people should look at Christians and see love, and that love ought to make the faith more credible. So Jesus is saying that I'm about to be glorified and to glorify the Father. And he's also giving us this commandment to love one another, and that love is to actually be an occasion of glory. Right? It's supposed to be a sign to the world of who Jesus is, who we are as his followers, who the Father is, all this. Right? So this commandment is to be taken very seriously. And if you actually read that whole five chapters in John, you'll see that repeated as a theme, this command to love one another, love one another, love one another, as I have loved you. But what kind of love does he have for us? It's not a pleasant one. Right? Jesus was not thinking of like Hallmark cards and stuffed animals when he said, love one another as I have loved you. He knew where he was going. This is the kind of love he has for us. So, brothers and sisters, if we take this commandment seriously to love, that's what we're called to do as Christians, love, then we have to know what love is. And I will tell you, and you will know what I mean, love is in crisis in 2019. Right? This is our word. Love is a Christian word. It's a Christian reality. And we have utterly lost control of it. We've lost control of it to the world. We've lost control of it within the church. We have gotten ourselves into a situation where everybody can say love, and we might none of us mean the same thing, and we might none of us be having the same conversation. And let me give you some examples of the fact that we have lost control of the word love. A few years ago, when all the states were starting to pass laws legalizing same-sex marriage, what was the slogan that everybody was using? Legalize love. Wait, what? I don't think we're talking about love here, right? Legalize love. That's the slogan. And when in one state, there was a picture when it was passed of a man out in front of a courthouse holding a sign saying, love wins. And as a priest friend of mine says, love did not win that day, because that's not what love really is. If we want another example, the fact that love has lost any sort of content, any sort of meaning, let's look at the other issue that's becoming hot today, literally this week, is abortion. And my students, who are always more aware of what's going on in the world than I am, they have been bringing it up in class. And all the things that for the last 10 years, you know, we've been trying to teach them about life issues that are abstractions to them are suddenly very, very real. And they're bringing questions like, Father, what do we say when they say this? Right? And one of my students said, I was talking to somebody, I don't know where, online, at the store, I don't know where. So I was talking to somebody this week, and they said, Christians only care about unborn babies. They don't care about born babies. They don't care about what happens when, you know, kids get put into foster homes or something like that. What do I say to that? And this is another example of love being robbed of its meaning. The enemies of life are using a bastardization of love to try to justify murder. Right? And they're pulling on our heartstrings. They're saying, look at this suffering child stuck in foster care, right? Without parents and bouncing around from abusive home to abusive home. You don't care about him. The subtext, and sometimes it's actually the actual text, is that it's better for this kid not to have lived. So we're going to use the bad feelings that surround looking at a kid who's had a rough childhood, and we're going to try to use that to justify murdering said child. And it's not actually very hard to show people the breakdown in their logic, because, you know, all you have to do is say, well, why don't we go to the foster homes and kill all the kids then? Right? And, you know, they'll recoil in horror, but that's exactly what we're proposing. And we're doing this in the name of love. How many homes have been broken in the name of love? How many families have fallen apart because, well, mommy and daddy don't love each other anymore? Right? We have lost our sense of what love means. Now, many, many, many of you have heard that there are four loves in Greek. I think there's actually five, but I don't remember what the fifth one is. But C.S. Lewis calls it the four loves, so we'll go with that. Now, you might have heard about me preach this before. You've heard it somewhere. The reason it's worth talking about is because it's an impoverishment of language that we take such an important word like love. And love really is an important word. It's not like peanut butter, right? I know at least two ways to say peanut butter in Spanish, but by the way. And peanut butter is not a very important word. Love is a very, very important word, and we have so overloaded it with uses that it is in danger of being useless. So I can say, in good English, I love my dog Athena. I love my mom. I love watching The Office. I love eating steak. I love God. I love my students. Right? Now, my relationship to every single one of those things is different, but I use the same word. That's an impoverishment. And if we're not careful, and we haven't been careful, we can actually lose our understanding of what Jesus means when he tells us to love one another. So be patient with me. I know this is a long homily, but I think it's an important homily. When Jesus tells us to love, he is saying agape. Or in Latin, we translate it as caritas. Or in English, we call it charity. Charity is love par excellence. Charity is Christian love. When Jesus talks about loving one another, loving our neighbor, loving our enemy, he's saying charity. Now, what distinguishes charity from the other kinds of love is very important. Because there's romantic love, or we call it eros. There's friendship love. There's affection love, like the love I have for my dog. There's a love we have for our friends. There's a love we have for our children, all those kind of things. Most of the time when we talk about love, we are talking about an emotion. We're talking about the affect. Most of the things that we talk about, when we talk about love, including romantic love and friendship love, right? The way we feel about our spouse, the way we feel about our friends, the way we feel about our children, all of that is, it's a beautiful thing. It's part of the human experience, but it's all in the affect. It's in the emotions, and it's not something we can control. Married people who have been married for a long time can tell us this. How you feel about your spouse is not something you can control. And those emotions come and those emotions go, right? Eros rises and falls, right? The affection we feel for our children or friends, it's stronger some days, it's strained other days. They're emotions. We have no control over them, and they're not in and of themselves moral realities. In marriage, for instance, you don't promise when you get married that you're gonna feel lovely towards one another all the time. You couldn't possibly promise that because you can't control it. What you promise is that you will love each other in good times and in bad, in sickness and in health, until you're dead or they're dead. That's what you actually promise. That's charity. Charity is the one love that is not an emotion. Charity is the one love that actually comes from the will. It's an action. It's a decision that you make. And frankly, it's detached from feelings. It's really wonderful when charity is supported by our affect, because then it makes it easier for us to do what we need to do. But sometimes they're completely separated. Sometimes we have to do the loving, the charitable thing, even when it feels crappy. Even when it feels like the opposite thing is the loving thing to do. Pope Benedict XVI wrote an encyclical on truth. It's called Charity in Truth, Caritas in Veritate. There's a really wonderful line in the introduction. If you don't want to read the whole thing, which is about social justice, just take 15 minutes and read the introduction. I really recommend it to you. It's online for free. He says, without truth, charity degenerates into sentimentality. That is absolutely true. And so we have a culture that preaches love all the time, that holds up being loving as a great value, but really has no sense of what it means to be loving, because love has become completely detached from truth. Love, as our culture talks about it, is purely an emotion. And brothers and sisters, I understand the difficulty of this. I'm not a robot, and I was not born into this world with Thomistic theology, right? I grew up in like felt banner Catholicism, right? I grew up with a faith of like self-affirmation. Right? Oh, God loves you. You don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to change anything because God loves you. Never really talked about what that means, what it means to love. In my high school, I graduated high school. I got kind of like Catholicism light, right? I graduated high school believing that what it means to be loving is to just sort of support and affirm and celebrate everybody for everything they do. All your choices are great, and we love you for it. Let's celebrate that. And I can tell you this. I really believed that's what it meant to be loving. And when I was 18 years old, I left high. If I did not meet Bishop Wall and Eric Westby, I may to this day be living a life of moral relativism, because at the age of 18, I really believed, actually, I had what I thought was a religious conversion, but was actually just a like kind of an emotional love fest, right? I experienced what I thought was a conversion, and I left my high school thinking that what it means to be Christian is that we just affirm everybody around us. That is sentimentality. That is love that has been separated from truth and therefore is devoid of content. Now, most of you have kids, unless you are kids. And if you have kids, you know in your heart of hearts the truth of what I'm saying. You know from experience that doing the right thing and doing the thing that feels good are often not the same thing. When Jesus tells us to love one another, that this is his new commandment, he means a love that's rooted in truth. In fact, if it's not rooted in truth, it's not really love. It's just good feelings. And Pope Benedict in this encyclical says that because of the way things are in the world right now, one of the greatest services that we can perform to charity is to preach the truth with courage and generosity. I'll say that again. One of the greatest services that we can provide to charity today is to preach the truth with courage and generosity. St. Thomas's definition of charity is to will the good of the other, right? It comes from the will. Pope Benedict adds, I think, a very important little clause in there, to will the good of the other and to take concrete, effective steps for that good. So we will encounter in our life, in fact, I bet as I say this, you can probably think about somebody that you're thinking you should have a difficult conversation with, that maybe you've been avoiding because it doesn't feel loving or because there's going to be fireworks or you're afraid that relationship's going to be damaged. But it may well be the case that what God is calling you to, as he calls you to love that person, is to first of all encounter them with the truth. I want to use an example to kind of wrap up of what this might look like in action. This example is limited because it involves a stranger, but I think it's just a concretizing of what I'm saying. So 2 days ago, I had a half day at school because it's graduation practice. There's not real school. So I got off at 11 o'clock. I thought, you know what I never get to have is breakfast. So I went out for breakfast at 11 o'clock. And I was eating alone because, you know, a priest. And so I sat down at one of those, you know, bars that looks out the window. And I'm eating an omelet. And a guy sits down next to me, seemed like a very decent man, very decently asked for the salt and pepper, and I passed it to him. It didn't look particularly heathenish or anything like that. He was wearing a suit. And then he starts talking on the phone in the restaurant. You know, he's sitting at the bar next to me. And the conversation that he had, I don't know who he was talking to, but the vulgarity that came out of this man's mouth as he was talking to this person on the phone was astonishing. You know, I'm kind of looking around. We're in the middle of a public place. This guy's just swearing left and right and just has this kind of like terrible conversation. And then he starts talking about like a Tinder hookup that he had. And I found out, by the way, the way he started talking, I thought he was like a frat boy. I found out he was 41 because he was telling his friend that he met this girl who was 31 and 5'10", right? And then he begins to expound on all the benefits of dating somebody that's 10 years younger and several inches taller than you. And it was shockingly vulgar and shockingly unaware of himself. And I thought to myself, I'm in my clerics, right? Which you get away with more when you're in clerics, right? Because if you try to preach the gospel to somebody, they're going to think you're a lunatic. If I try to preach the gospel to somebody, they're going to think I'm a lunatic, but that it's my job, right? So so I'm thinking somebody should say something to this guy. Because for one thing, he needs to know that what he's doing is just not okay. It's not socially acceptable. It's not respecting the common good. But also, I know, because what I know about the human person, this man cannot be happy. The way he's living, the way he's talking, this cannot be making him happy. He might think it's making him happy, but it's not. And maybe nobody has ever called him out. Maybe nobody's ever confronted him. Maybe nobody's ever offered a better way. And this is my chance to really love, to do charity. It's not going to be easy, right? Nobody likes doing it. I don't like doing that. I don't enjoy being a truth teller. I'm just willing to be a truth teller, right? So guess what? I paid my check and I walked away because it's just too unpleasant. Who wants to deal with that? That was a moment where I really was called to charity and failed. And maybe nobody has ever preached the gospel to that man or invited him to a better way of living. And for all I know, maybe nobody ever will. Maybe that was the moment and I was the guy. But I couldn't overcome the sentimentality of how unpleasant it was or whether it would make a scene or what he's going to think about me or what he's going to say to me. And I'm a priest. It really is my job. The reason I say it's not that good of a story is because, you know, there are people in your life you have greater responsibility to. You have greater responsibility to your family members, to your close friends, your coworkers, not just strangers in the street. But the truth is, we are called as disciples of Jesus Christ to love. And that love is to manifest God's goodness in the world, to be a light to the world. And love, the kind of love that Jesus is talking about, really has nothing to do with feeling good. And we are watching the world essentially burn itself to the ground because we're afraid to make people feel bad.